as we turned into the Corbury Road, the snow began to fall again, cutting off our last glimpse of the house. And Frome's silence fell with it, letting down between us the old veil of reticence. This time the wind did not cease with the return of the snow. Instead, it sprang up to a gale, which now and then, from a tattered sky, flung pale sweeps of sunlight over a landscape chaotically tossed. But the bay was as good as Frome's word, and we pushed on to the junction through the wild white scene. In the afternoon, the storm held off, and the clearness in the west seemed, to my inexperienced eye, the pledge of a fair evening. I finished my business as quickly as possible, and we set out for Starkfield with a good chance of getting there for supper. But at sunset, the clouds gathered again, bringing an earlier night, and the snow began to fall straight and steadily from a sky without wind, in a soft, universal diffusion more confusing than the gusts and eddies of the morning. It seemed to be a part of the thickening darkness, to be the winter night itself, descending on us layer by layer. The small ray of Frome's lantern was soon lost in this smothering medium in which even his sense of direction and the bay's homing instinct finally ceased to serve us. Two or three times some ghostly landmark sprang up to warn us that we were astray and then was sucked back into the mist. And when we finally regained our road, the old horse began to show signs of exhaustion. I felt myself to blame for having accepted Frome's offer, and after a short discussion I persuaded him to let me get out of the sleigh and walk along through the snow at the bay's side. In this way we struggled on for another mile or two, and at last reached a point where Frome, peering into what seemed to me formless night, said, "That's my gate down yonder." The last stretch had been the hardest part of the way. The bitter cold and the heavy going had nearly knocked the wind out of me, and I could feel the horse's side ticking like a clock under my hand. "Look here, Frome," I began, "there's no earthly use in your going any farther." But he interrupted me.
"Nor you neither. There's been about enough of this for anybody."
I understood that he was offering me a night's shelter at the farm, and without answering, I turned into the gate at his side and followed him to the barn, where I helped him to unharness and bed down the tired horse. When this was done, he unhooked the lantern from the sleigh, stepped out again into the night, and called to me over his shoulder,
"This way."
Far off above us, a square of light trembled through the screen of snow. Staggering along in Frome's wake, I floundered toward it, and in the darkness almost fell into one of the deep drifts against the front of the house. Frome scrambled up the slippery steps of the porch, digging a way through the snow with his heavily booted foot. Then he lifted his lantern, found the latch, and led the way into the house. I went after him into a low, unlit passage, at the back of which a ladder-like staircase rose into obscurity. On our right, a line of light marked the door of the room which had sent its ray across the night. And behind the door, I heard a woman's voice droning querulously. Frome stamped on the worn oilcloth to shake the snow from his boots, and set down his lantern on a kitchen chair, which was the only piece of furniture in the hall. Then he opened the door.
"Come in,"
he said. And as he spoke, the droning voice grew still. It was that night that I found the clue to Ethan Frome and began to put together this vision of his story.